It's not working. It's not working. Get rid of them all.
Kick them all. 10 men rugby.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the new rugby podcast from the Irish Examiner. I'm your host, Duncan Casey. I'm joined by my co-host, the man that puts a smile on my face every time I see him, the glorious Duncan Williams. In today's episode, we'll be catching up with Donal Lenehan, talking to him about the upcoming Six Nations campaign, some of his own experiences in his time in national camps. And we'll be catching up with Jack Crowley, the Cork Connaught half, who is likely to be in the starting jersey for the under-20s for the course of this campaign, but certainly this Friday night. Duncan, I haven't actually seen you in a while. We've been messaging over and back over the last few months, but how has retirement been treating you? What have you been up to?
So obviously I finished up in end of May. Well, looking back at it, I was probably well finished by November. I was picking a few splinters in the old dressing room for a good while before that. But
I know how that feels.
Yeah.
So 8 months of it.
So I finished up in the end of May, went, took a good break with my wife and kid. We actually went to John Ryan's wedding over in Girona for
A very lavish affair.
I was showing myself in the free drink and everything. So yeah, we went there, so that was in Girona, and then we stayed on for about 2 weeks after, just about a half an hour away from there. So it was a lovely break, got away from everything rugby, relaxed, put on a bit of weight, no training whatsoever, so it was a nice break. Then came back in July, was still hoping to kind of play on at that point. Kind of hoping that maybe something might come in for World Cup cover over in France. Would have been ideal, Pro D2 even better again, because they have a good system. Nice, a couple of weeks off there. Yeah,
four weeks on, one week off.
So it would have been ideal. But look, it never came. And I just trained away, took my time, met a few people, kind of putting out a few feelers for jobs, and kind of started then the grad program in Keepak in October. Had a trip to Bermuda for the classics as well.
Yeah, how was that actually? I haven't spoken to you about that since.
Yeah, it was very good. It was very good. It was
A week long?
Yeah, it was 10 days. So we went on a Friday and back on a Sunday. So it was heavy going now, drink-wise.
It's obviously one of the better ones to get on, but it's essentially like a club rugby tour. Essentially, you get in the piss as soon as you arrive.
It's a fine junket, yeah. So we I think our flight from Dublin was 6 in the morning, so we were in Gatwick for 8:30. I think we had our first pint at 9, and our flight from Gatwick wasn't till 2:30, so barely remember getting on the flight. Drank all the way over, so I think we were drinking pretty much solid for about 48 hours realistically. So then we woke up on the Sunday, and our first game was the Monday. We were all hoping the game would be called off at that point, because we were just in the horrors. We played the States in the first game. It's good. Actually, the rugby was good quality. It was a lot tougher than what I thought.
Is it kind of ex-players from all over the place, or is there actually teams of current players as well?
No, it's all retired players. So there was the Irish team, USA, the Lions, France, Italy, Argentina, South Africa, and I can't remember who the other team was. But so we played the States in the first game. It was a tough game. Actually, we managed to win that. So see, the thing is, if you win the first game, you get a good kind of run of the week then between drinking and playing matches. So you get a good couple of days drinking, then your next match. Whereas if you lose the first game, the drinking is really curtailed as a result of the way the games fall. So the big emphasis is to win the first game. So we beat the States, and then we had to play South Africa in the second game, which was highly embarrassing because we were on the beach all week drinking. These lads were there and their speedos ripped to the gills. Not artificially, obviously. And
any notable names playing for them?
Man Pugita that played with the Waratahs, big tall second with the long hair.
Charles
McLeod, actually. Did you play with him in Grenoble?
Charles had just left. He left Grenoble when they went down, so he was at Stade when I arrived.
The nine with the kind of long.
I met him.
Nice. Butch James was there. He was meant to play, but I think he was just coaching. They gave us a good hiding anyway, I think. They were 7-0 up within 30 seconds.
And it's a 15 aside.
15 aside in 25 minutes and a half, yeah. But it was a great experience. I was glad I did it. It's an interesting 10 days, to say the least. It's good because the partners get to come over as well.
All right, yeah.
So we go on a Friday, they came on a Tuesday, so a nice little break for them as well. It keeps everyone happy.
Oh, of course it does, yeah. That's what, were you, I know you were playing with Conno, obviously, but were you ever at a point where you were considering finishing up?
Yeah, so I was training through the summer and I was thinking about doing a bit of coaching, and as I said, I was hoping to maybe play on in France or whatever. So then I was like, I was talking to a few lads, say Mike Sherry, you know, he was saying that he'd love to be able to play. Obviously his shoulder was at him, so he was kind of
hanging off him.
Yeah, yeah.
To put it mildly.
I kind of felt a bit bad. I was like, I can still play, so why don't I? It's kind of towards the end of my Munster career, I kind of fell out of love at rugby. I wasn't really enjoying it.
Yeah,
I went back and played with Condac from Christmas onwards, and I actually began to enjoy it. You know, it was great brand of rugby. It was very entertaining. We were actually winning. We won the AIL. So I was like, you know what? It's kind of the same team for Con again the following year. So I said, look, go on, I'll play on. I was originally kind of trying to keep myself fit for Bermuda after the France didn't work out. So I'm still there anyway, slogging away. But
how are you finding playing AIL now?
Yeah, it's good.
As kind of your primary contact with rugby, does it remove a lot of the shit that I suppose would have come with things not going your way for the last season?
There's still the odd fella in the crowd giving me jipper. One of my friends was at it there a few weeks ago, right? And I think we were on our like 5 meter line or something, and so I kicked the ball out like a normal kick out the touch, like clearing kick. He's like, if that guy kicks the ball again, what do you want me to do? Like, we're 5 meters from our line, it's pissing rain. So, you know, you still have those kind of fellas, but no, enjoying it. As I said, it's kind of playing rugby with a smile on my face, which I suppose wasn't always the case when you're a professional.
Yeah.
You know, I know I was reading, Keith wrote an article, or had an article there during the week, you know, saying he always played his best rugby when he was smiling. And for me, sometimes that's not easy to do in professional rugby. I was always jealous of someone like Zeebs who could play absolute muck for 75 minutes but still be having the time of his life and end up getting 3 tries and be a hero. So,
no, it's very true. Like, it is, particularly when things aren't going your way, it's hard to stay motivated.
Yeah.
And I think that triangle.
You only know it too well yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, there was that triangle of misery in the corner of the changing room, the two of us and Mike Sherry. So yeah. I think. Well, at least you were playing like even when you weren't really figuring, you were figuring the odd time. Whereas when we weren't figuring, we weren't figuring at all. Like,
yeah.
I was like, because I remember before in the lead up to when I went to Grenoble, I ended up playing 80 minutes for Grenoble 3 days after my first training session, just by nature of the fact that there were 2 injuries and a suspension, so they had no choice. So I played 80 minutes and I could not believe they were leaving me on. I kind of got to 60 and I was starting to look at the sideline and I was going, okay, any minute now. Then I got to 65 and I was completely useless at that stage. Yeah. Well, it seems like you're pretty content with the moment that you've rediscovered some passion for rugby. Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to do that.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd play anyway if I could, but I dislocated my hip with 8 minutes to go in my last game.
You had a good track record over in Grenoble, right? How many games did you actually finish?
I came on and went off more than I had at any other point of my career, for sure. And there was one in particular, I had been out with a hamstring injury for 2 weeks and then ended the 3rd week, came on off the bench, and I think I was on for about 90 seconds, got a concussion, was back off. So yeah, that kind of thing. I always still have that scare. Yeah, that kind of thing happens though.
But you took to traveling in a way straight after your retirement.
I did. Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah, well, I'm back in UL next week, so I have to do the second semester of a master's I was doing before I went to France, which they very kindly let me put on hold for a couple of years. And I had kind of 5 or 6 months to play around with before that started. So rather than just kind of hanging around Ireland and waiting for college to start. Sorry, my girlfriend and I had always intended to go traveling for an extended period of time at one point or another. So it was just a good opportunity to do that. So,
and could you run us through the glamorous places you went to?
So we started in Istanbul, went to Lebanon, Armenia, Georgia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, North Korea, South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, and New Zealand. Okay. So,
and knowing you, I presume you stay in hostels for all of this with your missus.
Of course, yeah. Well, now it'd be piggish if you were trying to stay in hotels in every country like that.
It's too lavish for you, too mainstream.
Exactly. I like the raw element of travel as well. So, But no, it was great. It was great. No, so happily retired as well. So I think we're both on the same page there.
Would you look to stay in rugby at all? A bit of coaching or?
I don't think so, to be honest. I never really enjoyed it. I never enjoyed coaching. Not that I enjoy helping people out. Mm-hmm. If I, as you know yourself, you'd be asked to kind of give a hand with stuff every now and again in a school or in a club. And
no, I don't actually get asked.
I enjoyed working with hookers, say, or that kind of thing, or even doing a bit of line out work. But when it came to actually like managing 30 or 40 people, particularly if it's young people, is a lot harder than I think people give it credit for.
You were very big into the mental aspect of things. Would you not be able to talk the youth of today through how to mentally toughen yourself up?
I was one of the most mentally fragile people you could imagine, I think, on balance.
If anyone's ever heard of this Wim Hof character, you need to look him up. Wim came in one day thinking this guy was
the answer to all my problems.
Yeah, so he's like, he can climb Mount Everest in his underpants.
Yeah.
So next thing, Dunk started doing ice baths at home, and lo and behold, he came in the scarf, sniffling with a chest infection after one attempt.
Cold showers, yeah. So Wim Hof, he's worth looking up. Basically, he's this Dutch guy who uses breathing to keep his body temperature high and to boost his immune system, supposedly, anyway. So he's done stuff like in experiments where he's been injected with a virus and he's been able to fight off the virus. He runs these workshops where at the end of kind of a week-long workshop in the Polish mountains, they go up and they literally climb mountains in their underwear. He's done stuff, he's run marathons in the desert with no water, that kind of thing. So he's a complete freak of nature. You
could do a lap without a bottle of water.
Of course, he's packaged this and he sells it as a product. So I love a gimmick, like, and
I bought a sinker.
But part of it is you follow this process. So there's breathing exercises, but part of it is exposing yourself to cold water, like ice cold water. So you do like at the end of your shower, you do it for 10 seconds, 20 seconds, and then you build it up every day to the point where you're having fully cold showers. I think I got to maybe like the eighth day. Came down with the worst chest infection I could recall ever
you
having.
You were always prone to them anyway.
I was, but that's what I mean. Like I would get at least one a year, maybe two. And that was the worst I can remember having. So I was bedbound for about 5 days with that. So that was the end of Wim Hof and me. But he's worth looking at, yeah. Donald, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
That's great. And best of luck, lads, with your new venture, the new Anton Deck of rugby in the south of Ireland.
Who's who?
We've obviously got the Six Nations coming up this week. I suppose in the greater squad, Donald, do you think anyone's particularly hard done by when not being included?
I have to say I was amazed when Rhys Ruddock was left out. You know, every time he's played for Ireland, he's been outstanding. He's now one of the driving forces in Leinster. When you see the younger fellas they have in the back row, obviously Deegan and Doris are getting the kudos. Van der Fleer still there playing well, but Ruddock seems to be the rock that they keep going back to. Again, he was used on a limited basis in the World Cup, but every time he's played, he was outstanding. So I was surprised with that. A bit surprised your own position as well. Niall Scannell going from sort of on the bench with Ireland consistently over the past number of years, waiting for his chance with Rory Best. Best finally retires and all of a sudden, I find it very hard to believe that he's not in the top three hookers in Ireland.
Agreed, yeah.
So it's a surprising one. But look,
Coach, was there only three names, was it? Yeah.
Three names, yeah.
I think so. And two of them are on one of them, Heffernan, has a couple of caps. Them, yeah. Kelleher, to be fair, has been outstanding,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, hard to leave a guy like that out, yeah.
But like when you consider Rob Herring, played second fiddle to Best for 5-6 seasons in Ulster, on the periphery of the Irish setup for a while, and now it looks as if he's primed to start. So
that's right, yeah. I suppose I hate hearing the term period of transition. I think it's 99% of the time it's not an appropriate time to use it at all, but I think it's fair to say now it's the end of one World Cup cycle. Yeah. The World Cup obviously didn't go according to plan, so Andy Farrell all things going well, has 4 years to plan for 2023. So it is kind of that period where you can play around with things. I don't think guys that have been left out necessarily might be left out again come the June tests. But I think it's interesting. Who are you looking forward to seeing?
I saw an interesting, was it a comment from Farrell saying that the squad has pace and power and suits the way he's going to try and play. So I was kind of worried, was that excluding certain lads that weren't named going forward unless something drastic happens? I don't know. I was hoping that wouldn't be the case for particularly someone like Niall Scanlon. As you said, I think, you know, he adds a lot to the team. You know, he has leadership capabilities. His set piece is very strong.
I think on his throwing alone, the Irish lineout hasn't functioned well for a good couple of years now. And I think,
but at Reece Ruddock, he's not the fastest, but he's kind of like the juggernaut. Keeps trucking, gets 3-4 meters every time or whatever. But just that perception, maybe, that he's not this fast man around over the turf or whatever. I don't know. I just hope that isn't, if a guy is playing well for his club, particularly.
Yeah, but I think that's why the selection is going to be interesting. And I have to say, I'm looking forward to the Six Nations, given that, that Irish side was pretty settled for the past 2 years. Mm. Obviously, speculation in the World Cup. It's very difficult in the middle of a World Cup to start making wholesale changes. I suppose the surprise that time, Larmour came in, played against Scotland in that opening game. Mm. Andrew Conway played in that. And despite the fact that they played really well, they weren't in the equation for the bigger games down the line. Everything about Farrell, I have to say, I've met him a number of occasions. I'm not sure whether you've been in dressing rooms when he's there, but he has presence. Everybody speaks really highly of him. Mm. He's been involved in the international arena now, 4 years with England, 4 years with Joe Schmidt in Ireland. This is his opportunity to make his stamp. So starting off as coach, getting 2 home games, is brilliant as long as you win.
Mm.
But the expectation, because it's Scotland, the fact that the opening game of the World Cup, that was supposed to be tied, Ireland blew them away. You have the Finn Russell issue coming in as well. The expectation is there that Ireland are going to win, so that brings its own pressure.
Yeah.
Like, you lose one or two of those opening games, all of a sudden you're on the road. The pressure is there already.
Yeah, I wonder with Ireland, like the media and stuff. Obviously, I don't know, will he be afforded the chance to bleed or blood in a few new lads and try a few new things out. Whereas if he loses and he loses, the media will be on his case. Whereas, like, you see New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, they do this with a couple of lads every year. They might win, might get the results, but they see the bigger picture. Even the supporters see the bigger picture. I just think Ireland, we can be great at putting our own down rather than getting behind them and seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah, and it's like, better than anyone. I mean, what impact, particularly the international level, when you've little or no time to prepare, like, what changes can you make style-wise in 3 or 4 training sessions? You can talk on broad basis about what you want to do, but in terms of making radical changes to the way you're going to play, I don't know, you tell me, is it possible to do that on the back of 4 training sessions?
Yeah, that's a fair point, and I think that ties into a lot of the chat around Munster at the moment. I mean, people seem to be throwing Larkham under the bus already because they haven't drastically altered the style of rugby that we're playing. Or that they're playing, rather. And I think, like you say, though, it's very difficult to change things in season or with limited exposure to certain guys, particularly the fact that the World Cup was on. People were coming back in dribs and drabs, having time off over Christmas. And I think, you're probably going to see... I think you'll see more expansive rugby from Ireland, for sure. Probably more encouragement to take risks, I think. Less conservative outlook. But on the whole, I mean, the bulk of players are going to be the same. The style of rugby isn't going to change drastically, I don't think.
When is Dan Levy close to returning?
There's a suggestion that he might now play before the end of the season.
Okay.
He's supposed to be flying training-wise.
Yeah. Great to see him back, I think.
Yeah, but there's another element. You see, Ireland now, they have a 2-test. Well, it's supposed to be 2 tests. There's thought there's going to be a 3rd test added to the Australian tour.
Okay.
Which is incredible when you hear all this talk about player welfare.
Yeah.
The Irish players, the World Cup squad assembled, I think, on the 16th of June in Carlton House. The first test in Australia is July 4, second test July 11. I know they're talking about adding a 3rd test in Perth, but brings you to July the 18th, so that's 13 months after they came together, it seems. Like, yeah. It's lip service, this whole thing about player welfare. It's all money. Bottom line is, I was there with Ireland 2 years ago, 2018, when they won that series. First series win down under since 79. But you could see there was talk about Ireland going back there immediately because Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, all three venues sold out. Mm. Third test in Sydney. Obviously, the Aussies thought they'd have the series wrapped up at that stage.
Yeah.
And all the Paddies bought the tickets. Yeah. I mean, it was phenomenal. The Irish support, both in Melbourne and in Sydney, was incredible. And I think the ARU decided there and then, because they're under massive financial issues in Australia at the moment. I'd say they were breaking down doors to get Ireland back. Mm. And now, having got them back for two tests, they're talking about a third test. So
that's crazy to have a 13-month season like that. It's just totally unsustainable. I think the Irish guys are more fortunate than their French or English counterparts, for sure, in the sense that there is a degree of management there that people just don't get in England. I remember looking at the minutes that the guys in the last Lions tour played in the subsequent season for their clubs, the Irish guys are all down the very bottom of that table, which is only fair. I know the latest agreement with the Rugby Players Association in England was designed, or at least ostensibly designed, to make player welfare more of an issue, but I think it's just lip service, and I think there was a lot of backlash to that. I mean, 10 months of playing games, even if they're quite spread out, you have to stay in shape in those off weeks, particularly for playing test rugby as well. You're not enjoying the benefit of those down weeks really to the same extent as other guys, and I think it's only a matter of time before the age of retirement, as much as it's decreasing year on year as it is, before it really starts to go down well under the 30 mark in the coming years.
Yeah.
But the whole shape of the season is changing almost. They're bringing it in under the table. You know, there was the talk of the global season a year or two ago, so we'd align ourselves with the Southern Hemisphere. But I was shocked. I was in the World Cup and I spotted that the Pro 14 final this year is down for the 20th of June. Was always in the end of May. So, and, you know, even in World Cup years, it was always in the end of May. It's now down for the 20th of June. You go 12 months out, the Lions Tour doesn't start until July. It's been reduced to 8 games, which is the shortest Lions ever. I think the third test is on the 7th of August. So where do those players go? You know, when you're generally after a Lions tour, the Irish players will be given maybe a 4 week break, but maybe 9 to 10 weeks before they actually play a match.
That's right.
So that nearly brings you into the November internationals. Seems ridiculous. All this has been sort of, it's come in almost unnoticed. And so, I mean, I have to say, every time I read about player welfare, and you're right in terms of the Irish players here are really well looked after, and you know, it has to be a factor when you're negotiating contracts. I know there might be more money elsewhere, but in terms of longevity, you know, the Irish system does work.
Yeah, and you just touched on the issue of contracts there. Donal, is actually a lot to play for a lot of guys who are coming off contract this year, who are just breaking into the Irish setup at the moment. You might be familiar with the fact that the issue of central contracts is becoming a bugbearer for the three weaker provinces, say, because basically as it stands, I think there's 16 central contracts at the moment. I think 9 of them are with Leinster, and I mean, all things being fair, on merit, that number would likely increase. The percentage of contracts that Leinster have would increase year on year, to the point where maybe in a few years' time it might be 12, 13 out of the 16 contracts are Leinster guys. But the knock-on effect of that is that that means that there's 12 guys in the Leinster setup whose entire contracts are being paid by the IRFU on a central basis, and that allows much bigger budgets to bring in the likes of James Lowe or equally dominant and powerful players that can have a really strong impact on the season. So they're talking about restructuring that at the moment. Have you heard much about that, Donal?
Yeah, it's raised its head. I mean, it's funny, I suppose, in the context of the whole salary cap and the Saracens thing, which is on everyone's lips. Like, people out there mightn't realise, you know, a player on a national contract might be on $500,000 a year. The province pay no money towards that. But then they have to fund the players in the province who, obviously, the IRFU is the overall paymaster as such, but it does make a huge difference in terms of the more central contracts you have, then the less onus there is. There's more money available, if you like. within the province for the other players within their squad. I mean, I must say that, you know, you go back to the Saracens thing, obviously the system they had where Nigel Ray and he had players, he was involved, they were involved in companies with him, co-directors. The problem was there, it wasn't an arm's length transaction. But we have a scenario in Ireland where a lot of our top players, their salary is topped up because of a commercial agreement with somebody like Bank of Ireland or somebody like that. Mm. So therefore, it's not a whole lot different to what was happening in Saracens, except for the fact, of course, that it is an arm's length transaction. But it's I can understand why the other provinces now are getting seriously concerned about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know that they get, obviously, having that many people century contracts that frees up more money, but I think their recruitment and identification of players has been probably better than the other provinces as well. If you look at the fellas they brought over to try and qualify for Ireland between James Lowe and Gibson Park.
Couldn't have gone any better.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and like James Lowe, okay, he had a bit of a reputation as a good player, but I don't know, I'd love to see how many clubs actually came in for him, whereas Leinster identified him and backed and went for him. Like, same with Gibson Park, you know, as I said, between himself and McGrath, you know, you can't guarantee, or you can't name the Leinster starting 15, you know, they change it week on week. McGrath doesn't always start, Gibson Park starts, and they do 60-20 or whatever. Same with other positions in Faraday in the second round, back row, it's the same. So it's, yeah, they have more player-centric contracts, but I also think their identification and their selection of players who they recruited has been much better than the other provinces.
But I think an element in that is that Guy Easterbury, who's sort of their operations manager, part of his brief is recruitment. Mm. So like they're actively involved, all despite the fact that they're generating all this incredible talent on an annual basis within the province. And, you know, obviously the school system in Leinster has got so many good things going for it, but they're also working well outside that in terms of the whole youths and the other counties within, and they're unearthing, you know, the Sean O'Briens of this world, the Shane Horgans in his time, they came out of the youth area. Tyke Furlong would be one now, and they're really doing that incredibly well as well. I suppose you'd have to question over the past number of years in terms of the overseas guys that have come into the other provinces, have they made the same impact? Now, having said that, if Munster do eventually end up signing D'Alende and Snayman, they're game breakers in my view, given you're now, and I would imagine for everybody else within the squad, when you hear Munster going for players of that quality, despite the, well, I suppose for everybody, as long as they're not in your position, but it must give you.
Oh, they were regularly for people in my position. Yeah, don't worry.
Exactly, but it must give you an incredible lift to think, yeah, look, we're playing with the big boys here. I mean, to be bringing in two guys who've just been part of a World Cup squad, it must be fantastic for your squad.
But even like, say, going back to James Lowe and Gibson Park, I think they're in the 23 and they're probably starting most games. Well, James Lowe anyway, but what they add off the pitch to the younger players coming through, I've no doubt that they're helping those lads, you know, giving, telling them about their experiences and educating them, whereas like it's not just guarantee or signing a guy who's going to be in the 23 every week, it's also how he's going to help develop. Like Dougie would have been very good in Munster, you know, Ruth Pokey would have been very good, Maps was very good for helping out the younger lads and stuff. So it's not just what they do on the pitch, I think it's all around between the culture and and educating the younger lads.
I think, yeah, there's a big tradition and culture that in New Zealand that probably is unmatched in other countries, and that's kind of...
Paul Warwick was another good lad for the younger lads, Australian, so...
I remember Francis Saili saying when he came that, when he rocked into training and with the Blues when Manonu was still there, so Manonu would pull up in his big Jeep at 6:30 every morning to watch the academy guys train. And he'd be there without fail every morning. And Francis said he asked him one time, and he said, "You just never forget where you come from. It's important to stay humble, is a big thing with particularly Polynesian guys and I think Kiwis in general." So you can definitely see how that has a really positive impact in a place like Leinster or Munster or anywhere else. So, as someone who has been involved at every level of rugby, Donal, from playing right up to boards and being management and everything else, Scotland at the moment, they seem to be going through a small bit of an upheaval. Obviously, as you mentioned a moment ago, Finn Russell was sent home from camp.
You would have been applauded into training back in your day, don't you? For going on the lash and missing training.
Well, I can tell you, the old halves were never the last fellas to bed in our time.
Blame everyone else for not getting them up.
Exactly.
But
I'd love to know who his roommate was. But anyway, I think the damage might have been done at that stage.
Do you remember that years ago at a site, on our away trip 1 year? And we stayed in like Cardiff or wherever, and we went out after. And was it Neil Tucker, the physio, was rooming with someone. And he got up and left your man, Murph, and Murph missed the bus. And Tucker was just sitting on the bus, didn't even bother trying to wake him up or anything. What an outrageous performance. Jesus. He slagged him for months after it. It was unbelievable.
That's terrible.
But after outing the poor old monster Murph. Physio or whatever he was.
So in addition to the Finn Russell issue, a couple of weeks ago there was a lot of discussion in Scottish media, a lot of outrage actually, about the fact that not too dissimilar to the John Delaney and FAO situation that we've been enjoying over the last probably 12 months at this stage, that Mark Dodson's salary had increased by upwards of 50% to close to £1 million. The overall paid to the board in 2019 increased from 1.13 million to 2.24 million. And I saw a good line from Tom English, who writes for the BBC, saying, "It's hard to know what caused the biggest tremor in Scotland this week, the winds of Storm Brendan whipping around the country, or the thought of Mark Dodson's wallet landing on his desk at Murrayfield."
Yeah, well, we know the Scottish fellas were never too quick to take their wallets out of the pocket, so one of them hitting the desk.
So as someone who's been involved, as I said, like right up to boards, as a manager, as a player, as everything, how much kind of upset can that cause in the camp of a national side? Will the lads be ignoring it? Does that kind of thing filter down?
Yeah, I think there would have been nobody within the Scottish setup who would have realised the CEO was on that kind of money. You know, when you consider like Scotland, right from the outset of professionalism, they've struggled financially, and a lot of it went back to the fact that they redeveloped Murrayfield only a couple of years in advance of the game going professional. So a lot of the resources that they had, they put it into bricks and mortars in Murrayfield at the time. Look at the flip side in with the IRFU, to be fair to them. Lansdowne Road was almost falling down, but they felt that professionalism was on. It was definitely going to come. It was only a matter of time. So they kept the reserves in order to give them a cushion for the inevitability of the professional game coming in. The impact of that meant that when professionalism started in Scotland, they struggled to get enough. Like they'd only, I think, three provincial sides at the time. Now they're going down to two. Trying to pick a national team when you only have two provinces or two districts, it means you're very restrictive in terms of your player numbers. So when you they still have only Edinburgh and Glasgow involved in the top professional sphere. So it seems incredible to me, given the revenues that they're generating, that their CEOs and that kind of money. For what I can gather, the likes of Philip Brown would be on a small fraction of that.
Yeah, I think Philip Brown is on, this was in Stirling, I know that I saw, about 172 compared to, I think it's 445 basic plus, plus 460 odd in bonuses. So
he deserves it.
But it is interesting when you see guys like Stuart Hogg, Finn Russell leaving, Richie Gray next season. You know, you can't, I think it's foolish to make a direct comparison saying this exact money could have been used to keep a marquee player like that, but I think it does show a mentality that's there that, as you say, Donal doesn't have the advancement of professionalism in Scottish rugby
at its core. You've got to get your priorities right. That said, I think that they have accepted in Scotland that because they only have those two professional outlets, that they try and keep their players when they're younger. But they also, I think, realise that there is a benefit to the likes of Gray, Stuart Hogg, gone to Exeter Chiefs this year, still playing outstanding. There's no doubt in my mind, Finn Russell has come on in leaps and bounds as a player since he's went to Racing. Like, he was always this maverick talent, but, you know, he just seemed uncontrollable, if you like, at times playing for Glasgow. Now, in that Racing environment, now it helps when you fellas like Vakatawa and Teddy Thomas or Simon Zeebo outside you, but that said, I think the quality that he's been producing is phenomenal. Now, I don't think he would have been at that level had he stayed in Glasgow. So therefore, you know, they are getting the benefit of that as well. But it's, look, I think my experience with players, they tend to blank out everything really that doesn't affect them from a playing perspective. Even I was remember players that, and you know, when coaches come and go, players are selfish in many ways. They just want to make sure they're on the team. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of instances, as I say, they blank out those issues. But that said, given where Russell's standing is in the Scottish game at the moment, you know, the fallout of him not being available for the Ireland game, like, that has to impact on the squad for all the obvious reasons. Whereas the financial aspect, really, you know, that's something that's out of their control. And I'd be amazed if that was an element that interfered with their preparation in any way for the Six Nations.
Don't we had a we had the occasional distraction or emergency in Munster while we were there. Did you feel it ever affected the group really when it came to preparing for games?
Yeah, look, I suppose I was at Munster for home 10, 11 years, and we had probably five head coaches in that length of time. Some left all of a sudden. I suppose Razzy left kind of a year and a half into it, which was, or 15, 16 months into it, which was rough enough going, especially after what we'd gone through the year before with Axel passing away and stuff. So yeah, like, I think the senior players did well there. They kind of got everyone in together and said, look, it's happening, let's get on with it, let's not use it as an excuse. And we just got our heads down and all kind of worked towards the same goal. And I think the importance of kind of more experienced players does come in massively there. It's it can be hard, like, especially if you're like, if you're a club that's not doing very well and something like that happens, it's easy to, I suppose, be a drain and kind of contribute to the problems. But I can see you laughing, thinking that that would be me, but no, it wasn't. But yeah, no, it was, as I said, it can be quite a bit topsy turvy time, right, John?
But you read all, obviously, every group, be it international, club, they always go on about the leadership group. I was just reading about the Irish 20s. They have six fellas, I think, in their leadership group. Like, you're just out of the professional game. Were you ever involved in the leadership group, number one? Or secondly,
I don't think I ever got a vote.
To go 11 years in the squad and you were never in the leadership group.
They were mainly trying to keep me out of the leadership
group. Surely out of pity they would have put you on in one year.
Well, it actually, so in Munster used to be like, say, five or six lads. There was one season there, there was about 25 lads in it, literally.
I still didn't get it.
I don't even think I got a vote still. But yeah, so
Is it a voting scenario? It's not just appointed some, by the coach?
Depending. I think it depends on the coach, and year by year it kind of changed. But there were, I don't think that happened every year in my time there, that there would have been a vote.
Yeah, because you'd be surprised when you actually do put it to a vote to the, say, 45 lads. You'd be surprised the names that come up. They're not always, like, it might be some guy that the younger lads, who isn't a, might be a guaranteed starter, but he helps them out. They see him as a leader and they want him in there.
But let's say that whole incident now with Russell, I mean, he's in the bar. I think he played for Racing that day against Saracens. Obviously came up to Scotland. Now, by all accounts, the Scottish management said, look, it was their first time together for a while. As you can have a few beers, but we're training in the morning. Obviously, we're not privy to what happened, but Russell didn't turn up for training, or he wasn't at training. Now, whether he was going to train, I doubt if you'd be training when you played a match only 24 hours earlier, but obviously you've got to be there, you've got to be part of the meetings. Like, surely the leadership group there, especially going into a Six Nations, and you have Stuart Hogg has just been appointed captain, they have a massive role to play in terms of sort of, there's going to be a lot of outside noise about Russell being sent home. The players have to take ownership and drive that issue in terms of getting right for the game against Ireland.
I'd be interested to get your views on actually, Donald, because as Dunk said, you've been involved in rugby at all levels, but you were obviously manager of the Lions in 2001 in Australia, and there was a fair few, I suppose, scandals from that between Austin Healey, Matt Dawson, Raj getting a hiding. Like, how important is the role of the manager, you think? Like, I think it seems a bit like that was one of my greatest rugby memories growing up, watching that. You know, I always watched the video of that Lions documentary. It was unbelievable. I thought it looked like unbelievable crack. They're a good, strong group, and I thought you played a good role between management and the players.
Well, Lions Tour is probably, it's different to all the norm, because you've got They're all incredibly talented players to start out with. You're a group that's together maybe for 8 weeks. That's never going to see each other again. So for some fellas, there's no consequences going forward. If you're an Irish international, you're contracted. That's going to impact on the way you conduct yourself to some degrees. It was like there was obviously a couple of issues there. Matt Dawson writing, you know, about pressure from the management and training too much and all that type of thing. But I think those days are gone, really. I mean, you were still in that transition between the amateur to the professional game. The Lions is all about the here and now. I mean, I remember I was under fierce pressure to send Dawson home after that particular incident.
So had he written a piece or had he given an interview?
Written a piece. Well, he was writing. It was a ghost. Well,
is that really? You said that the manager were putting too much pressure. I couldn't remember what the
actual... Well, there was the funny thing, you see, in those days... Players had only started writing articles and they were all ghost written, number one. And now, of course, every time there was an issue, well, I didn't say that or I didn't do that or, you know, the poor old ghostwriter was being hung.
Blame the journalist.
Blame the journalist, exactly. No, it was the morning of the first test. And we did train incredibly hard in the first 3 or 4 weeks, but all with a view to being right for the test series. And, I mean, that was an amazing tour. You look at the build-up. I think we played the Queensland Reds 2 weeks out from the first test. They had been in the semi-final of Super 12, I think, as it was at the time. They had about 8 or 9 of the Aussie team. I think we put about 40 points on them. We played the Waratahs the Saturday, 2 weeks. That was the day when Raj got the head bait off him. But Tom Bowman got sent off from the kickoff.
I mean,
Danny Grucock, I think he elbowed him into the head. Yeah. That was the start of it.
It also coincided with one of the greatest lines in pressure rugby, your one after that. We were set up, we played like a bag of shite. One of my all time favourite quotes.
Did I say that? Did I? Jeez.
Hit the nail in the head though, to be
fair. But I remember, I always remember coming in after that. I think we lost in that game. We lost Lawrence Delalio. You're a week out from the first test. We lost Richard Neil Back and we lost Will Greenwood. I remember Martin Johnson was captain. He got split over the eye, and I have to say that was the day when, as a captain, as a leader, just as an inspirational person, he just really stood out. I remember we were in the after the game. Raj was being stitched. I think he might have got stitched when he was taken off. Went back out onto the field, but Johnson was lying down on the physio bench. They were stitching him. And he said to me, well, what's the story with the injury? So I said, it looks as if Greenwood is out, Back is out, Delalio is out. And he just kind of, and he just shook his head. Right, we just get on with it.
You know,
I think if you said, look, we've only 13 fellas left and we're going to have to play on. And that's the kind of guy he was. But it's probably not the best example because Lions Tours, as I say, they're you know, they're one-offs, fellas never come together again. But I think it's the senior players have to drive that as they did that time as well.
Hard hitting, sometimes brutal. Brilliant at the breakdown and never afraid to tackle the big names. Read Ronan O'Gara, Simon Lewis and me, Donal Lenehan, in the Irish Examiner for the best insights and analysis on all the key matches throughout the Six Nations Championship. The 2020 Six Nations in the Irish Examiner. We've got every position covered.
Earlier in the week, I was down in Fota to catch up with Connaught half Jack Crowley, who's been selected for the 20s side for the upcoming campaign.
Good, right, Jack Crowley, I suppose it's fair to say that outside of people who follow the All-Ireland League relatively closely, not a huge amount of people know much about you right now. I'm sure that will change over the coming weeks and months, but you've had a pretty terrific season so far. You came out of Bandon Grammar, this is your first year out of school, and you were selected to captain Munster A in the first Celtic Cup match of the season. You've been instrumental in Cork On having a perfect season so far, 10 wins out of 10, sitting comfortably atop of Division 1A in the AIL, and now you've been selected for the upcoming Irish Under-20s campaign in the Six Nations, so you must be pretty happy with how things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a pretty good year come this last 2019 and 2018, but you know, there's been, as you say, with Cork On and Munster have been playing with a lot of quality players, so it does make your role as a 10 a lot easier. So I can't take all the credit for that. Just steer the ship as well as I can, and other fellas play their role as well. But no, it has been, you know, I've got unbelievable opportunities throughout the year, and you know, it's just taking your opportunities, and I think I've done that, but it's not over yet. So should be, and it's delighted to, you know, it's unbelievable honour to get selected, you know, in this 37-man squad. So yeah, it should be hopefully a good campaign now.
Course. Just to rewind a bit, obviously, as I said, you were in Bandon Grammar for six years. That's where you kind of honed your craft there, and in Bandon RFC as well. I went to Glen Salaby myself, and I know it's been remarkable to see how Glen Salaby progressed in the last few years.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, that didn't quite happen when I was there, but I would imagine it's been a similar enough situation for yourself. As you said a minute ago, before we started recording, you graduated from being a B school to an A school in fifth year. What's it been like to watch Bandon kind of emerge as a real talent, producing guys like Darren Sweeten and Gavin Coombs, and now yourself in recent years, whereas previously wouldn't have really been considered a hotbed of rugby production?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's been like, from them to go to a B school, like they've always been competing, you know, in the B Cup or whatever, but in the last few years we've had, you know, there's coaches in the school that have really been trying to push to get up to an A school, and I suppose in the last few years we had the introduction of Régis Sonnez, the French coach now at Toulouse, coaching Toulouse, and I'm sure many of you know him, but he kind of brought a brilliant ethos to the game of, you know, like we had all along, I think the players have been there, you know, year on year. Like there was, go back to Gavin Coombs' year, even before that, you know, they were just shy of the opportunity, and I think they needed someone to really show them that they could have pushed on to an A school. I think it could have happened earlier with the talent that was in the school, you know, it's just about maybe not realising the ambition or, you know, pushing themselves. So I think the quality was there all along, and then we just got a brilliant opportunity with Régis coming, and there was the men before that as well, all the coaches and everyone in the school already jumped on board, and you know, it's unbelievable to see kind of there's a change now in West Cork with the ethos of it and the mentality of it, that you know, you can, you know, they're an A school now, you can really push on, and like Glen Stahl have proved coming up and winning 2 years ago, which was pretty first time ever.
So unheard of.
Bandon Grammar, hopefully he'll get there, win sometime as well. But no, it's been unbelievable, and I think it's brilliant for rugby in general, just, you know, not just having two A schools in Cork, now you've three, so it really just has developed rugby a huge lot in West Cork and has promoted really well.
Absolutely, and Bandon RFC are doing very well currently over the last couple of years. And I saw someone mention last year, I think that, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but there were more people from Bantry than Limerick in the full Munster Academy. So things are obviously progressing in the right direction for rugby in West Cork.
Absolutely.
Big men down there. With regard to Cork Con, joining Cork Con, it was obviously the natural choice for you to join as a club. I would imagine that being an out half coming straight out of school, joining a team like Con, it has its advantages and disadvantages in the sense that you're obviously playing with the cream of the crop in terms of AIL rugby. But at the same time, I would imagine that there's a lot of expectation on a young out half's shoulders to come in and perform the way you have. Brian Hickey isn't known for taking many prisoners when it comes to the level of expectation he has for his players. So how have you found settling into that system?
It's make or break. Like you have to challenge yourself. I think that was my main thing. You know, people are saying that you go to Cork Con, it is going to be challenging, and I wasn't going to expect there to, you know, strut into the team. I would have taken seconds if I had to, just game time. But you know, I think that's kind of part of me as well, as to be pushed a bit and, you know, challenged. And like in Con now, the tens there, Aidan Moynihan and Jerry Hurley. Unfortunately, Aidan broke his leg before Christmas, but like, you know, them pushing you when they come back is going to be what challenges you. And I think that's, you know, as I spoke about before, competition, and like at that, when this fella's, you know, on your tail pushing you and stuff, it really does help you. And then having experienced fellas next to you like Niall Keneally and Alex McHenry and stuff, it, you know, it helps you develop as a rugby player. Those lads have been playing at AL for a number of years now, so you learn little things off them. But yeah, it was, you know, I could have went to a number of other clubs, could have stayed at Bandon, but I said I'd, you know, challenge myself and see what it is like, and make or break, as I said, if you get in there, it's good, like, but no, it is good to challenge yourself, I think.
You were lucky enough to have, like, the AIL is very much a young man's game these days for the most part. I know my own club, Shannon, I think 26 or 27 is the age of the oldest guy that's playing there, and it's been like that for a number of years. Con have a number of guys who are late 20s, early to mid 30s as well. Guys like Jerry Hurley, who've been there for as long as I can remember, and I know Duncan Williams is obviously featuring regularly in the Con side as well. What's it been like to work with a nine like Duncan with the level of experience he has?
Yeah, he makes it a lot easier anyway when you're stuck in shit. So he can help you out, all right. But no, you learn many things off a man like him. Like, he's been a professional player for what, 12 odd years more. So I think just being able to play outside him is just, you know, it's unbelievable, because he's puts the ball on the plate. Same with Jerry Hurley when he plays there. Same with the other nines. It's, you know, it makes your game a lot easier, as I said. And then having Niall outside you and, you know, players of that. So Duncan, you know, is ins and outs of the game very well. So it's brilliant for learning off him.
Another guy that wouldn't take prisoners, I would imagine, certainly with this pack. So it's not bad to have a nine barking at them like that.
Absolutely.
Making sure the ball is on a plate for you, like you say.
Yeah.
So you're in the sub-academy now. Are you based in Cork still?
So I'm in college in Cork, in UCC. Right. And
OE. What are you studying?
I'm studying commerce. It's not too bad getting through with it and stuff. So we go up, we train in Limerick in the HBC, which is an unbelievable facility, and we're there Monday, Tuesday and Thursday. And then if you're playing with AIL at the weekend, you head down Thursday and club train and play Saturday. So it's really good up there. The facilities are top class.
In terms of, like, that'll be obviously your first taste of a fully professional environment. When back in my day, 10 years ago, I started in the sub-academy, and it was very much kind of a part-time gig.
Yeah.
It wasn't anywhere near as demanding as it is now in terms of the hours you're expected to spend at the HBC, the amount of time you're spending actually on the field with the other lads.
Yeah.
How have you found it adjusting from schools rugby? Has it been a big step up? Is it more or less what you expected?
Yeah, it's I wouldn't say demanding in the term of that. You know, you wanting to, the end goal is to try and get an academy out of it for us. So, you know, that's what the academy are doing week in, week out. So to transform into from sub to academy, you want to be doing similar enough hours to them so that it's not a huge jump and stuff, which is, you know, it's, you want to, we all love rugby, I'm sure, playing it. So to be in an environment where you're able to sometimes get a lucky opportunity to train with the seniors or train against them with the A's, it's, you know, it's unbelievable. So to be up there and in around the gym and stuff, it's really good. And, you know, putting in the hours, I'm sure if people weren't up there, if I wasn't up there, you'd be trying to put in as many hours at home on the pitch, whatever, kicking, passing, tackling. So, and then in school, we actually had quite a heavy session as well. We had two gyms in the mornings and a pitch session every day. And then Wednesday you play a game, or on Saturday. So
it's not a completely different
it's
experience. Okay, well, that's good. Yeah, I mean, again, that sums up just how much schools rugby is.
Yeah, easier. So
that's right. Yeah, schools rugby is bordering on semi-professional stuff nowadays for young guys in particular. Munster kind of getting a lot of flack at the moment with regards to not producing enough players, homegrown players through the academy. Out half isn't really a position where that argument could be made at the moment. No. There's yourself, Jake Flannery and Ben Healy now, all in and around the same age, which is going to be really exciting to see how that plays out over the coming years.
Yeah.
You're kind of the understudy at the moment. Obviously, Ben made his European debut yesterday.
Absolutely.
How do you approach competition like that? Is it kind of a long term thing? Have you identified ways that you can get yourself ahead of the two lads, or is it just a case of concentrating on your own game at the moment?
Yeah, well, like, I think, you know, as I always talk about the competition that they bring, you know, Ben, it's unbelievable milestone for him to be able to get his Champions Cup debut, and, you know, he took the opportunity that was on, and all credit to him. And same with Jake, had an unbelievable under-20s campaign last year, and World Cup as well. So, you know, they kind of have set the standard of what's expected throughout the year with under-20s, both performing really well last year. So, you know, you got to match them, and at the end of the day, it's all about competition, and we're fighting for the same jersey when it comes to it. So, no, I think at the moment you have to learn off fellas like this as well. You know, they've been to an under-26 nation, they've been to the World Cup, so I think learning off them at the moment is a thing, and constantly learning and, you know, pushing each other. I think that's the way it creates healthy competition inside the training centre. So fellas like them, you know, they've they've put in the hours week in, week out, kicking and passing. So I think you just got to match that and try and outwork that, whether you can or not. But no, I think it's brilliant to have quality players like that, and you can benchmark yourself off them and see where you need to go from there.
Duncan, what's your experience been like with him? He seemed like, struck me as a very impressive guy with years on his shoulders, really very mature.
That's the word I was about to use, very mature. You know, he's not shy. He knows what he wants. He demands the ball. He's all the attributes, you know, and he's got a good head in the shoulders. So it'll be, I've no doubt he'll excel in the Six Nations coming up.
He's a big lad. I was actually a bit shocked when he came out. He's about 6'2", I'd say. He looks heavier than
no,
he is.
No, you're just 5'4", yeah. So he looks like he's 6'2".
Fair point, yeah. He felt like 6'2", anyway, but he's big for 10. I think he said he's 88 kilos, which for, I presume he's 18 years old, is he? Maybe 19?
Yeah, but I've developed his skills massively by throwing gutter balls. He's learned how to pick a few balls up off his laces, so it's I'll take a lot of credit for his performances.
Don't you've heard good things? You've seen good things?
Yeah, well, I saw him play for Bandon last year in the semi-final. They should have beaten Prez. They had them beaten twice and left Prez back into the game. I think had they got to the final, they could have beaten Christians in the final. They were that good a team. And they were that group of players that Reggie San, do you remember the guy? Mm. He's now coaching in Toulouse. They were the group that he had as under-12s, and you could see their skill levels were outstanding. I'd spoke to him on a number of occasions. In fact, when he joined Conn, I organised for him to meet Raj. We was over before with the World Cup. We had the night in the Clarion with Steve Larkham and Johan van Gran, Raj and myself. But exactly what you say, Raj couldn't get over the size of him. Like he was towering over Raj, but even his physical development, I don't think Raj, even at the top of his game, was... even physically at the level that this guy was at 19 or 20. Again, as Duncan said, the thing that struck me about him was his maturity. He knew exactly what he wanted. When he came out of school, you know, the natural thing was under-20s rugby. He didn't want he felt he was good enough to play in the All-Ireland League. Obviously, his target was also the Irish. His immediate goal was to get on the Irish 20s. And you know, he's in that squad. Hopefully, I think he is probably favoured to start in the campaign. But he is an exciting talent.
And great to see. Obviously, Munster getting a lot of stick at the moment. As I mentioned when I was speaking to Jack, for not producing enough homegrown players, but they've got himself, Jake Flannery and Ben Healy, all in around the same age. And
Conor Fitzgerald was.
That's
Munster,
right.
Yeah, well, before he was one that got away before them, was it? Yeah.
And James Taylor in UCC, who's an outstanding 10, chose, I think, his own.
He's playing with the club side. He got picked. I saw it.
Yeah, he's playing with the amateur team. But I think he would have, you know, certainly Munster had been onto him on a number of occasions. He wants to get his degree, but he's another outstanding 10. So it's great to see Munster producing players of that quality.
The other thing I would say about Jack is he strikes me this guy who just loves rugby, you know, eats, sleeps, drinks rugby, and I would just hope that he doesn't lose that. You know, things can sometimes get a bit too much, you know, especially now the under-20s are on the TV every week, so I just hope that get the better of him. So I just hope that he never, obviously at some point he'll not be as in love with her as he is, but I just hope in the long term that he manages to stay that enthusiastic about his rugby.
Yeah, he doesn't strike me as a guy that'll get distracted too easily anyway. So
I don't mean distracted, but you know.
I know exactly what you mean, but he sounds like you said, Donnelly, he knows what he wants. And
let's put it this way, I hope he doesn't hate rugby as much as we did for about 5 years.
He's glad you're painting a terrible picture of professional rugby.
It's the best and worst job, Donnelly.
A lot of things have to go wrong before you get to the levels of depression we experience, I think. Just before we wrap up, guys, we obviously all, and I think a lot of people listening would have seen our old teammate Bailey Holland and his wife Lan Lee talking about their really, really difficult and moving experience with their daughter Emmeline, who passed away last May. They gave a terrific interview, really composed, really impressive, on the Late Late Show last Friday. It's well worth checking out if you haven't seen it yet on the RTE player.
But they set a target of 100 grand for their GoFundMe page, and last we checked it was at 480 grand, and that money's going to be split between the children's unit in CUH, Crumlin Children's Hospital, and Ronald McDonald House. So anyone that would like to donate,
it was an unbelievable reaction to, you know, to unbelievable people, so it was good to see.
It is, they're fantastic people, they really are, and as I said on Twitter, they deserve every happiness in the world. So if anyone would like to donate, it's not too late by any means. You can go to GoFundMe.com and searching for Emmeline Holland. That's E-M-M-E-L-I-N-E Holland. I think that's about it for the moment, guys. Donald, thanks a million. Pleasure to catch up with you.
Thanks a million, lads.
Thanks, and, Donald. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Best of luck to you now the next few weeks.
I'd give it 4 weeks, but the time we're back down would have been cancelled.
We'd be taking her job next.